Welcome back to Evolution of a Snake. I'm Zach.
And I am Madeline.
And we're back with another gorgeous episode of Tay Rewind. Girls, there's not a lot of Tay Forward going on. We have to Tay Rewind.
Yeah, there isn't a lot of Tay Present. There's Tay Future.
There's always Tay Future.
But there's nothing that we can do about that at this present moment. We just have to speculate about Tay Future. But there's only so much speculating that we can do. She won't show us the dress.
She won't show us the dress. She will show us her hair. But what I will say is, for minute developments in the Taylor Nation, you simply have to be on Patreon. Patreon.com/astrologist. Trust, we're talking about it. It's just that we can't make an entire episode out of her haircut. Trust, we tried.
We tried. The conversation was had. And no, we decided, you know what? This actually... It sort of tests our integrity. Like, we can't do an entire episode about hair. People are saying it. They're saying
we could, but if we did, it would be lowering the bar. And we're not trying to lower the bar here on Evolution.
We're trying to raise the bar.
No.
We're trying to raise the bar.
We want to uplift everyone. And we're going to uplift everyone by reminding everyone of a time when Taylor Swift was extremely uplifted. This is The Power of Taylor Swift, an article from 2014 about Taylor Swift's release of 1989 and her new philosophy on life, music, the recording of her music. There are, as always, when we go back in time and the butterfly effect comes into my mind, I'm like, if one thing had been different, everything could be different today. There's so much in this article that, like, hits different in 2026.
It definitely hits different, and it makes you realize I'm kind of reading about a different person.
Who is that? And the article starts with a complete oh no moment. So let's just get right into it, shall we? At 8 o'clock on the most exciting night of her life, America's most important musician, say it, was leading several dozen fans in a performance of Happy Birthday directed towards a young woman named Kaylee who had just turned 21. She presented Kaylee with a bottle of champagne and a card. Do you know what drinker you are yet? The 24-year-old superstar asked the 21-year-old as she put her arm around her. Are you a happy drunk? Can I say she'd get canceled if she did that now? If this anecdote came out in 2026, Tay groomer, Tay underage alcohol enthusiast.
God. You're promoting underage drinking. She just turned 21.
No, she is.
What do you mean? Does she know what kind of drinker she is yet? How dare you?
She should never even have heard of alcohol before.
This is like, it's funny. How long ago, 2014, 2015, actually was? Girls, it was 12 years ago.
We're about to get a really good reminder of just how long ago it was. Earlier that day, in the same Manhattan event space, Taylor Swift had charmed music biz executives while waiters circulated with French lamb and lobster canapés. Her fifth album had come out that morning. She greeted bosses from iHeartMedia, formerly Clear Channel, recently rechristened, and took pictures with them and their awestruck daughters. She hugged Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, I forgot about this.
Who got her a role in The Giver like an old friend.
And you know what? I want everyone in the comments to go silent in this moment. I find, you know how often I find that, like, people care less, I swear to God, about what Harvey Weinstein actually did than they do about the fact that Lana Del Rey mentioned Harvey Weinstein once or Taylor Swift met Harvey Weinstein once. What do you mean she hugged Harvey Weinstein?
And why did we have to give up cola for Harvey Weinstein, by the way? Hasn't he taken people of the world? I'm not giving it up. Harvey's in the sky with diamonds. He is. I'm sorry. That's what's happening in the song. But, I mean, it seems like should be no big surprise to everyone because Harvey Weinstein was, like, in the walls of Hollywood. Like, if you wanted something done and you wanted to be in movies, which, as we know, her role in The Giver, like it was a role. Like it was a role, like she acted, like it was a part, like it was a prize.
As if it was a part, as if she had lines, as if she was even there. I saw that movie in the theater, if you can believe it, with my brother. He was like, what have you taken me to? Don't worry about that.
You said Taylor's acting debut. And he said, what acting debut? Exactly.
Exactly. Wig. Exactly. That's what debuted that day. Wig. That's
lucky Harvey didn't give her anything better. Thank you, Harvey Weinstein.
Because it doesn't come up.
No, it does.
Thank God.
So I find it interesting. Then they kind of talk about how, you know, after the suits went home, they were serving pizza, and Taylor got into like a more casual outfit and all her fans.
She's just like us.
They love to do the early Taylor profiles, love to set up the whole, she's a businesswoman, but also she's really relatable to her fans. Like it's the most irreconcilable thing in the world. And I guess at the time it was.
Well, especially this was right around the time when I think Jennifer Lawrence would have been one of the most famous actresses in the world. Come on, man. I'm just going to have a slice of pizza. I'm just like one of the dudes. Like, that was such a thing to be one of those girls at the time.
I'm just Jennifer, like you.
I respected you then. I respect you now. When people said she's so annoying, I said, I don't see it. All I see is a beautiful queen who eats pizza. That's all
and
I
is
see.
And it's hilarious. What's wrong
and
with
it's
that?
Hilarious. Mm-hmm.
And falls over sometimes. Queen. Mm-hmm. Relatable. Mm-hmm. Relatable content. So Taylor says about these people, these teens that have gathered in her home, they're discovering the music that tells them how they are going to live their lives and how they should feel and how it's acceptable to feel, she says. I think that's kind of exciting. To her fans, she has recently started speaking out on two connected matters of importance to her, the music business and feminism.
Let's go back.
And only let's one of those back. Things is important to her now.
Yeah, let's go back. I'd love to return to this kind of a vibe. You know what I'm saying? You read it
well,
now.
What
and
she
think,
says
cringe.
About feminism here is crazy. What she goes her feminism in this article, it's like one of my favorite depictions of the contradictions of Taylor's mindset. Like she wasn't at the deprogramming of Miss Americana yet. There was still programming.
Oh, she. That's the weird thing about like 1989 Taylor feminism. She was still programmed. The
no,
program,
you really shouldn't. They shouldn't have asked her questions about it because.
No, I really think, reputation forward. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? We can kind of look at more of a feminist angle. 1989 Taylor hadn't had that really formative moment that a girl has where she essentially realizes, oh, these people don't even think I'm a human fucking being. And as soon as that happens, you're like, oh, I get it. Okay, now I'm going to cook.
She just became friends with Lena Dunham and was like, this sounds like something I should care about. But also, if I'm going to spill my tea, when people critique Taylor's feminism, to me, her most hollow feminism was the 1989 feminism because it was truly in service of brand narrative. Don't talk to me about my boyfriends. Don't ask me about my boyfriends. I'm going to have all men on stage at the Grammys who made this album and all men on stage at the 1989 tour. I think she got a lot more, it became more of a personal issue to her after 1989. The events of it triggered the real feminist awakening, the goth punk moment of female rage.
She really was just kind of parroting talking points. And you know what? At the time I said yes, because the opposite is way worse.
The opposite is way worse.
I really was cheering like a wild, because up to 1989, I mean, just for good context for people who didn't know, she hadn't said basically anything about feminism since 2008, where she said, I'm paraphrasing, but it was essentially like, I don't want people to think I hate men. I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly what she said, but it was something of that ilk years
which is
earlier.
Crazy, because other things that you do would lead people to think that you hate men. Not the feminism. What about the I'm gonna kill you if you break my heart? What about that?
She didn't even realize what she was doing. Queen. She didn't know she was already doing it. She just needed to have her eyes opened.
No, she's been feminist from the beginning. She doesn't know that. She's actually most feminist when she's not aware that she's being a feminist.
And that's why it's powerful.
That's why it's so powerful. So then she says something else that was programmed into her that I don't think she necessarily fully was with, which is they're talking about how all of her music had just vanished from Spotify. And Spotify was really starting to become a thing. And she said that this particular model of it devalues her work. She starts talking about Beats Music and Rhapsody. Beats Music and Rhapsody.
Beats Music.
Ain't
heard those names in a while.
Of who's that? She basically says, like, you have to pay a premium package to access my albums. That places a perception of value on what I've created. On Spotify, they don't have any settings or qualifications of who gets what music. I think that people should feel that there is a value to what musicians have created, and that's that. This shouldn't be news right now. It should have been news in July when I went out and stood up and said I'm against it in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. I love how she's, like, fighting her invisible op to this journalist who's asking her a question. She's like, and another thing.
Yep. She loves to do that. She loves to do that.
And actually something I forgot that was done in response, Spotify CEO revealed what Taylor's payout was for the 12 months of streaming before 1989 came out, when it was just the back catalog on Spotify, and it was $2 million, which I feel like is not that much for an artist that size with that many streams. But this was also a long time ago.
Yeah, it's hard to think of it in today's terms, because it's like I almost can't even think of what that would have meant in 2014 as compared to what it would mean today. How $2 million in streams today? Well, Ella Langley.
I think it's
cooking,
hard to get $2 million from streams.
I know Ella Langley.
You need to get like billions of streams to get millions of dollars.
Yeah.
The Spotify dust up made one thing especially clear. More than anyone else, Swift knows how to create albums that people will pay for. According to Nielsen SoundScan, Swift was the nation's best-selling artist in 2008 and 2010 and number two in 2012. The last 3 years she released albums. There's every reason to expect her to finish number one in 2014. They're predicting that she's going to get 1.287 million copies of 1989 sold in the first week, the best album sales per week since 2002's The Eminem Show. And we needed to dethrone him, and we needed to overthrow him.
I'm mad that they didn't include who was number one in 2012. Was it Adele, perhaps?
I bet it was Adele or Katy Perry. Could it be Katy Perry?
Yeah, that makes the most sense. It's like, give us the tea at least. I want to know.
The writer goes on to compare her to Eminem again. The two are the most successful writer artists to break in and sustain such levels of popularity since the 90s began. Among her peers, Rihanna and Miley lean far more heavily on outside songwriters, while Gaga and Beyonce haven't matched her sales. Swift is the only artist to have three albums sell a million copies in their first week since 1991, when the SoundScan started keeping track. Before 1989, she sold nearly 70 million digital tracks and Billboard blah blah blah. Her last tour grossed $150 million, the biggest tally country music had ever seen. She has 46 million Twitter followers, putting her in striking distance of Barack Obama, if behind Katy Perry and Justin Bieber, her reported antagonists.
I love the subtle phrasing of things in articles like this. Oh, fucking kills me.
It's so shady.
Antagonists.
It is so shady.
I also love this 2014 nugget of 46 million Twitter followers being like, oh my God, alert the press. It used to be a big deal back then.
I was doing some research for a Lady Gaga video, and one of the sources was like the most liked person on Facebook. And I was like, oh, right. That was
a
thing.
We used to care about that. That was a thing.
We used to care. We don't anymore, but we did. Yet, as financially secure as Taylor may be, she worries a great deal about her industry's future and her own, periodically falling it into, as she puts it, rabbit holes of self-doubt and fear. She says, it's a really important thing that I manage my anxiety when it comes to the future because, you know, I have very few female role models. That scares me sometimes. She says she looks up to Mariska Hargitay, the Law & Order SVU actress. She's one of the highest paid actresses in general, women or men, on television. And she's been playing this very strong female character for, 15 years? Swift once gave Hargitay and her husband a ride home from an Ingrid Michaelson concert. She later named her cat Olivia Benson. Who cares? Okay, this is an unnecessary detail. She connects with people so well because she's simply herself. I adore her, says Ina Garten, by the way, in a text to Taylor. Before we get into the issues with this, let's just wrap it up. No one in music has captured Swift's admiration in the same way. It's not for lack of talent. It's instead a matter of the challenges female artists face as they age. I just struggle to find a woman in music who hasn't been completely picked apart by the media or scrutinized and criticized for aging or criticized for fighting aging. It seems to be much more difficult to be a woman in music and to grow older. I just really hope that I will choose to do it as gracefully as possible. She likes to think, she says, about what her grandchildren will say one day. It's easier than worrying about her millions of fans. She knows that one way or the other, her grandkids will tease her. But I'd really rather it be, look how awkward your dancing was in the Shake It Off video. You look so weird, Grandma, than, Grandma, is that your nipple?
One of the strangest passages in modern literature. So let's start with what she admires most about Mariska Hargitay is she has so much money. I found that very telling. She makes a lot of money, and that's what you admire the most about her. She mentions, the strong female character, but it's like, what's the character about, though? You're not wrong to admire Mariska. There's a lot going on with her as a female in the center of pop culture. There's a lot there. But she goes, she makes a lot of money. Right.
That's the first thing.
What about the what about what existed in the context of all that came before you? Nothing about that. Second, I mean, to be fair, the last time she had a female role model, she said, if you're going to sing, good luck.
That was my first thought. It was like, examples of women in the music industry aging. I was like, well, I can think of one. who well there also was a time like
I mean a lot of women that like Taylor could have looked up to in 2014, just for example, Courtney Love has also not been particularly friendly to the humble
Stevie
reference.
Was there.
Well, sure. But it's interesting to me that she's like, I don't have a lot of female role models. The ones that I do aren't in music. It's like, okay, I guess that's fair enough. But then she launches into this tirade about like, well, you're not allowed to age. Okay. And then secondly, she says, well, I don't want my nipples out there. Okay.
And that makes you better than who? Because
I can't get what. Why does she have no female role models? That question has not been answered to me. I can't figure that out. She won't say. It's like,
well,
I mean,
she also posits that information to us. That's not like a question that she was asked.
We didn't ask.
She openly and she says it. She says it like she's trying to make a point. Like, I have very few female role models. Okay, but perhaps that's a failure of your imagination. There are plenty of successful women for you to look up to. What about Rosa Parks? What about Maya Angelou? You know, there are female role models for you, Taylor, that are not. And what she really means is, I view, and this is, it's neoliberal white girl feminism. I view feminism as, I can be a billionaire. And I'm not a billionaire, and I don't have the most money, and I'm not the highest paid. So until I am, feminism isn't happening the way that it needs to. But when I am a billionaire, then I will trickle down. My trickle down feminism will extend to all of the artists. And has that happened?
Yeah, it hasn't trickled down to me. I think, you know, the you know, Roe being overturned and Taylor becoming a billionaire, that might have happened in tandem. So I don't know.
Well, and then also it's the, I don't want my grandchildren to be embarrassed of me having my nipple out. It's like, okay, but I thought you supported women.
I guess she said, I don't, she said, I support women. I just don't really think about them.
She said, I
and I don't look up
unless,
to them.
Unless you're a slut and a whore, then I'm not, and you're poor. If you're poor and a slut or a whore, then you can't really be my inspiration.
Grandma, is that your nipple? I don't know how, she was still programmed. That's all there is to it.
No, it's astounding. It really is astounding and honestly hilarious to me. Hilarious. Then we go back to when Shake It Off came out. 1989's lead single has been out for a little more than a month when I visited Swift in September at her parents' home in Nashville. The song, Swift's danciest to date and her second Billboard number one, covers the business significant to her of bad publicity and haters in the world at large. In person, Swift is taller and thinner than you might expect. Do we have to throw in thinner there?
We didn't.
And it's a man. Again, it's always a man making these observations. She speaks in a low voice. That's another thing they love to say about her in interviews. Engagingly and crisply, we sat at a table on a patio beside a babbling pool, and she tucked her legs under her body while we talked. So then we get into, obviously, every article needs to do context setting, so it starts talking about Taylor's deal with RCA, blah, 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 how hard it was, how much she worked, Scott Borchetta's introduction here. And then it talks about how 3 months after its release, the debut of Taylor Swift would be certified as gold. Easy enough, right? No. Seemingly everyone who works with Swift cites her uncommon determination and exacting nature. A former ATV executive who first signed Swift says that even at 14, the singer would decline the help of 40-year-old men and long track records of country hit-making success. Ryan Tedder, who has written and produced songs for artists from Beyonce to U2 and wrote two songs with Swift for 1989, noticed her focus too. 95 times out of 10, if I get a track to where we're happy with and the artist will say, that's amazing, it's very rare to hear, nope, that's not right, but the artists I've worked with who are the most successful are the ones who will tell me to my face, no, you're wrong, two or three times in a row, and she did. And then Liz Rose, she chimes in, she says, and another thing, a bunch of girls have come to her requesting them to write Taylor songs, and she says, honey, no, only Taylor Swift could write those songs.
Gag it. Liz Rose, thank you for the gag. I miss when people could speak so candidly about what it was like to work with Taylor. I think Jack has maybe said a few things in recent years. Aaron, I mean, if we get a quote out of Aaron, it's a happy day. It's a happy day. But yeah, I miss getting like quotes like this. And I miss when people used to ask Liz Rose questions.
There's lots to ask.
There's a lot to ask. Oh, if I had 20 minutes alone with Liz Rose, I'd be prepared. I would have my notebook. I'd have my notes. This is not a casual conversation, ma'am. I'm asking my questions and you will answer them. Thank you.
And I'm going to need access to all of your files and all of your documents and every written piece of material that you have. I'm going to need to see it all. But I think that it's interesting how every single time her creativity gets brought up in any context, in any era, the number one feedback that is given is that it really is her driving the boat. Like, she is the one doing it. The thing that people say consistently is that they are her editors.
I think it's so interesting that that has been the narrative since the beginning and it's never changed. And people still say, well, she didn't really write her own song. She's a co-writer. You wish she were a co-writer. That's what you wish. But she's the person. She's the girl. This is why we need another Speak Now. I'll say it. Yeah, I'll say it. We need another 100% totally self-written record. Will it ever happen? Probably not. We have Speak Now and it's special. And I think actually, like, if I can backpedal a lot, I think actually
I can take back what I just said.
We have to preserve. It's really kind of special that Speak Now has that legacy. And like, she doesn't need to do it again. Like, proving it and proving it and proving it is like insulting to her at that point. It's been proven. And if you don't believe
her,
that's more
in so many ways.
Right. It says more about you than it does about her at this point. So period.
At her best, she can write stories like Joni Mitchell's and set them to melodies as memorable as Pharrell's. But she can also sell like ABBA, traverse genres, proving stronger than the format constraints of strangled scores of high-profile artists, and attract an audience that seems more vast and more loyal than any other artist. She has introduced to her fans an earnestness and craft, a form of romanticism that seems to be in short supply elsewhere in society. She has pulled it off in an era that seems dead set against such triumphs, one in which audiences are far more likely to splinter than to coalesce, all while masquerading to many as a teen idol hiding in plain sight. I actually think that's like a really perfect distillation of what is really special and unique about Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I was just thinking, there was another article, I think the most recent article we read, where they did the thing that just happened where it's like, she's like X if X was Y, and she's like Z if Z did W. But this one I didn't find as annoying, because I think the people that they chose was actually a really good description of what it is. She writes stories like Joni Mitchell. She writes melodies as memorable as Pharrell's, but she can also sell like ABBA. It's like, oh, to somebody, you know, who's not in the know like us reading this in 2014, that would paint like a really vivid picture of like how chameleon-esque she is and like how talented she is and how she has a lot of spoons in a lot of different pots.
Especially because this was coming at a really important narrative, like, inflection point in her career. Like, with 1989, she was really billing herself as an adult artist. And that last line about masquerading to many as a teen idol is so true. And that was a barrier that she really had to break through, being seen as the Miley, the Demi, the Selena equivalent. And it's no shade to them, because like, they are their own writers, their own artists that came into their own right at a certain point. But Taylor has, from the jump, creatively, been in a completely different league and conversation than those artists, right? Like, it wasn't manufactured. The bedrock of the Taylor Swift thing is the Taylor Swift pen. And that was not the case for most of the teen idols of that time, which I think made her she was an ingenue. She was rare. She was exceptional. Carly Simon, who duetted with Taylor on You're So Vain before a sold-out stadium crowd, said that Taylor is a shooting star. As a songwriter, she reminds her of herself. She's coy about the subject matter, but she's another kind of performer. I wouldn't compare her to Joni Mitchell, Carole King, or me. On stage, she's a showman, sort of like Elton John. I love that.
That's a really good quote. I like that. Yeah, I wouldn't compare her to Joni Mitchell in terms of the way she performs either. It's just like a completely different thing, which isn't a shade to either of them in any way, shape, or form. But it's kind of the same thing as being like comparing Lana Del Rey, the way that she performs in a live setting, and comparing it to Taylor. It's like apples and oranges. Like, what Lana does when she's really on, it's very, you know, and like very beautiful. It's just her standing there, elegant, glamorous, melancholy, et cetera, et cetera. And it can be very moving. And then there's Taylor. And it's like, just because they're different doesn't mean that they're any less impactful. Elton John. Yeah. She's Elton John. And I think we should bring it up more. I think we should say it up more. And I think we should say
it again. I prefer it to the other comparisons. I do. One day in early 2014, Ryan Tedder, the producer, songwriter, and One Republic frontman, was walking down Abbot Kinney Boulevard in Venice, California, when he got a call from Swift. She wanted his help on her new album, and the energetic Tedder knew it was a match from the start. If anyone else's bloodstream has trace amounts of Red Bull, hers does, he says. Did you know her to be a Red Bull drinker before?
No.
I didn't know
I don't
that.
I think he just means that she's always on. High octane. Like, she's incredibly energetic. It would shock me to discover that Taylor Swift has consumed a Red Bull.
No, I can't.
Because I just think...
Don't. She's coffee.
I think she's coffee. Yeah, I think she's a coffee girl. And as she should be.
Yeah, she should be. She told him that she loved the 80s and she wanted snapshots of every era of pop from her life. Most important, Tedder says, Swift said she wanted him to ditch every notion he had of her sound. There is no country on this album. Pretend I'm this new artist who just needs to make this album that defines her career, she told him. It's so interesting to me that she like went in with that intention for the album before writing the songs. Because I feel like before, the idea for the album kind of came together once she'd written into it. But this one, it really sounds like she started with a mood board and like an idea and a vision of what she wanted, and then worked specifically selected people to execute that vision with her.
It's also really interesting to think of her saying, this album will define my career. It's really interesting to go into
imagine
something with that.
Imagine if it didn't.
For a hot second there, it really did. And mm-hmm. I think we wouldn't, I wouldn't say that today. That's the crazy thing. Like, we've come so far from that. That's like, I'd say the Eras Tour maybe defines her career, maybe, but it's like, even that is like, it's so big now that choosing just one thing. But like in 2014, when this was the fifth album, it's like, yeah, I would say this was pretty definitive.
Yeah, there's a before and after point in this catalog. A lot of people consider, I think actually older fans consider this the beginning of New Taylor.
Yeah, I could see. A lot of people think that this is like the start of New Testament. Honestly, I think it's the last page of the Old Testament. I've always felt that way. It's like a closing chapter on something to me.
I'm kind of like I would even put Reputation is borderline Old Testament to me. I kind of view it as the Big Machine deal versus Universal as the splitting point. But Reputation and Lover
is the start of New Testament. And you know what? There's something shocking about that to me. Lover, New Testament, Taylor. Because to me, Lover is so singular that it's like the concept of it like being the right out the gate. This is me now is like, well, that, but it wasn't. I don't know what it was, but it was something else. It was something else. And you had your moments, but I don't know. I think people could make any kind of, some people think Folk Evermore. Oh, that's the real start of her real career.
Well, here's the gag is that she's been gagging it over and over. So it's like,
yeah, that's the thing.
There are different points where you can make it.
Right. Right. She's one of those people that just like, she's done so much now, and 20 years is such a long time. We could sit here and make timelines upon timelines upon timelines of like, this happened. So that, and you know what I mean? Like, make a whole map, and everybody could have their own individual map. Everybody thinks
of it differently. But there's one album that doesn't have a map on that subject. There is.
Who is she?
The Life of a Showgirl. Heard of it?
I've heard of it.
Unfortunately, now that I think about it, in my worst case scenario, in my worst dreams, I will not allow to come true. Life of a Showgirl is the beginning of a new Testament, Taylor.
There's something to that. I think that it probably is. It matches with like Lover being the start of the New Testament, the original
New Testament.
Let's go there. Because there's something to that.
The best thing about Showgirl is that Showgirl is like Lover, and after Lover came Folklore. That's meth math.
That is the meth math. And people keep saying this. People are really, it's like, okay, I don't
think.
We're
the ones. We put it in our show.
We've said so many things, though. That's the thing, is like, you get up on stage every night and like you talk about the same album again and again and again. You couldn't pay me to like, oh, say a thing that you said every single night about Showgirl. I don't know.
Oh, that. Well, we have the slideshow. That
we
can
could
help
go
us.
Back. We could go back and analyze the text, but.
So then they go on to talk about, and I think this is interesting. Like, this is kind of stuff we've heard before, but I think the way that it's phrased is interesting. Even though 1989 is her fifth album, released 8 years after her first, it may indeed come to define her career. It marks Swift's split from Nashville, both literal and figurative. The old marriage was always one of convenience. The Pennsylvania-reared Swift, no more authentically country than a coastal Cracker Barrel, found in Nashville a chance to make it on the strength of her songs. Had New York City or Los Angeles, the nation's other two music-making capitals, found Swift first, surely they would have sanded down her rough edges straight straighten the curls from her hair. Since Swift has been in Nashville earnestly from the start of her career, she was welcome to stay as long as she liked. Her country writing had always been sharp, even by the genre's tough standards. Fearless offered 15, which situates Swift's ninth grade romantic troubles alongside those of her real life best friend Abigail, and builds and builds until "Back Then I Swore I Was Going to Marry Him Someday Until I Realized Some Bigger Dreams of Mine." Some of Swift's detractors said that she was crusading for chastity, but the song captures too the wrenching myopia that every high schooler suffers. Okay, so the last part is kind of cokehead nonsense, but I think it is a really interesting idea that Taylor could not have existed in the context if she didn't go to Nashville. Because frankly, it wouldn't just be that they would have like sanded down her edges and like straightened her hair in New York or LA. I think her value proposition to them would not be clear, because she would be like, hey, I'm this girl that kind of can't sing and I have all these songs that I wrote. Would anybody like to have them? I think the answer would be no, we're going to go with the fourth Britney Spears imitator that we met this day. And that is their mistake. But I think there was no reality where she would have even become a signed artist if she wasn't in Nashville.
I definitely think, and people don't think about this enough, I think to a lot of newer fans especially, not to get them, but it's like I feel they fail to realize just how important her country roots actually are to like who she is as a person. And even when she makes an album like 1989, or she makes an album like Folklore, or even she makes an album like Showgirl, there's evidence that she is still, to the absolute foundation of her bones, that like Nashville signed country girl. And that's the artist that she was allowed to like flourish as in Nashville, signing like with a Nashville label and getting to do the Nashville thing and the country thing for so long. I mean, just look at a song like Ruin the Friendship. In another timeline where there's another version of Taylor Swift who immediately came out the gate with something like, I don't know, 1989, we would never have a Ruin the Friendship from that version of Taylor Swift. I'll tell you that for free.
No, it's true. It kept honestly being forced to chase two girls, lose the one for a while, doing country and pop, I think was really good for her, because it showed her that she can be multiple things at the same time. And something else with country that I think is unnecessarily restrictive is how dogmatic they are about your country credentials. Like, for example, here it's, she's no more authentically country than a coastal Cracker Barrel. That's true. And yet, her country writing had always been sharp, even by the genre's tough standards. It's like, you can question her credentials all you want, and you can question Beyoncé's credentials all you want, but if it's a good song, and if it adheres to the genre's standards, it's a good song. A good song is undeniable. The biography kind of, like, defeats the purpose when it fits naturally into the category. And Taylor definitely did that. I do wonder, like, what her relationship to country is now. Like, what percentage of her listening experience to music is still country.
I wonder if she's streaming Choose in Texas.
My heart has to say no.
Well,
but we know she's not streaming Kacey Musgraves.
I'm in love with Tennessee. Is she streaming Kelsea Ballerini?
No one is. But she's giving her a hug and taking a selfie.
I could see her giving Megan Maroney a spin maybe once or twice, but like when I look at who's really, I don't know. She doesn't mention anybody. By the grace of God, do we know that she listened to the Phoebe Bridgers record? Only by the grace of God do we know that. But like,
I'd love to know what goes through her head with that.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. It goes right back to Phoebe was the first person she called when she got her master's back. It must be one of those friendships. It's one of those friendships that they don't go out in public together. So to us, it's like they're not that close, but they may be incredibly, incredibly close for all we know.
They're doing sad girl texts.
But I don't know, like, who in country right now would be some, in mainstream country, would be somebody who's catching Taylor's attention enough. It ain't Morgan Wallen. It ain't Ella Langley. Megan Maroney, maybe, but like, we're not allowed to have access to this information now. So it's like a guess is a guess. Kacey Musgraves.
But remember, Taylor used to do randomista pulls from songs. Like, she found that Nashville song by David Mead that had like, he's like not famous, has no other hits, has no hit album. And she was fucking streaming that and making it her own and doing a cover on the Speak Now tour. So I'm kind of like, does she still discover music that way? Like, she just randomly like looks around, lurks and finds what's good? Or is she like an Ed Sheeran, I'm going to watch the charts and listen for inspiration?
I don't know. She won't tell us. I have absolutely no idea. That whole, that part of how she operates, like what kind of music she listens to be honest, like there's been times in her career where we've gotten more of a glimpse. I've always found it kind of confounding. Even when she was doing ARM lyrics every night, I couldn't find like a thread. You know what I mean? It was always just like, I'm listening to anything. I've got Jimmy Eat World.
I think she's more of a songs person. Because she's so lyrics oriented, I think like instead of being like a huge fan of an artist, she's like a really big fan of a song by an artist, which explains why she's obsessed with everybody that she knows. Because she probably like really like with Mary J. Blige, she really identified with Doubt. Doubt was her song. That was her song. Is she a Mary J. Blige-ologist? I don't think so.
No, no, but she should be.
No, she's a Dashboard Confessional-ologist. We know that.
Well, because of Abigail. I think if it weren't for Abigail, she definitely wouldn't be.
Thank you,
this
Abigail.
This has digressed to a place where I have no clue what we're talking about.
I'll just get back to the article. I'll get back to the article. While recording, now something that I found very interesting, and we're always talking about this, is what is the relationship between Scott Borchetta and Taylor Swift creatively when they were working together? Because this contradicts something that Taylor has said before. While recording 2012's Red, Swift found herself in need of a new sound. Borchetta, the president of her record label, heard a version of her song Red produced by her usual collaborator, Nathan Chapman. Borchetta says, the song was brilliant, great melody, but I told them the way it was recorded, guys, the production just doesn't match the song. It needs a pop sound. So Chapman and Swift asked Borchetta if they could take another crack at it. They did, and it was worse. Borchetta says, than the first pass. And Taylor basically said, all right, would you call Max? She had to fight her ass off to get that call with Max. He is really sanding it down and making it look like it was his wise judgment that led them to Max Martin. But you're the one that tried to put a fiddle on We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. I won't forget you.
That's why he's going to hell. That's why he's never going to see the pearly fucking gates. It's one thing to like force her to beg and beg and beg to have her music career the way she wants it to go. It's another to get into Time magazine and go, well, it was my idea all along, you see.
And he does that a lot. Like, I came up with the idea for Speak Now. Taylor wanted to call it Enchanted, but I wanted to call it Speak Now. You're nothing. Did you know that?
Where's your album? He couldn't stand the fact that she had a mind of her own and her mind was smarter than his. He hated that.
And it's interesting how, because by Taylor's account, they were telling her that her career was over and she had to fight tooth and nail to get them to agree to 1989. And all of a sudden, he's been good with the pop stuff from the start. I don't think so.
No, and he suggested it. Oh, right. I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did when there's so much evidence to the contrary. There's so much evidence that you begged and begged and begged for her to stay country, stay country, stay country. My ass.
Well, I mean, we have to just look to his incredible taste in other pop artists such as Florida Georgia Line and Little Big Town.
You know what? But if we're talking artists who made hits, Baby You a Song, You Make Me Want to Roll My Window.
Well, Taylor loved that one too. Taylor loved that song.
Now, let's talk about a song. And she was right. But the other Big Machine signees,
where are they now?
He really struck gold. He did.
And he knew it. And he knew it. So then she talks about how she picked Max Martin as the executive producer for 1989. And she says that her goal was, drumroll please, never heard this before, a sonically cohesive album. One that didn't straddle genres as Red and Speak Now had. And she has achieved it, writing an album louder, snappier, and poppier than anything she released before. Tedder says it was entirely Swift's doing. People will look for a hole to punch in the Taylor Swift poster and say, oh, you've got Max Martin, me, Jack from Fun, established hitmakers. But any one of us will tell you it's really Taylor. We're acting as editors. She's driving. We're along for the ride. On 1989, Swift changes thematically to deadpanning about her man-eater reputation in Blank Space and describing for the first time a girl who cheats on her Tomcat boyfriend in style.
A Tomcat.
A Tomcat boyfriend. You know an old man wrote this.
Hairstyles is a Tomcat.
A Tomcat. The old Swift rarely explored gray areas, yet she says, when you're growing up and essentially publishing your diary for the world to read, you end up incorporating new themes as these themes become evident to you in your own life. True.
It's so true, and it's so powerful, and she's so right to say it. You know, this is the power of Taylor Swift.
This is the power of Taylor Swift.
This is it right here. This is it.
Then they go on to describe all of the various hideous things that were happening to her pre-1989 release. So we're talking about lightning rod for slut shaming, when everybody was being mean to her and Ellen was doing her evil slideshows mm-hmm. of this boyfriend mm-hmm. that you kissed. And they go on to comment, since 2012, Swift's public image has morphed in tandem with her private life. Her last public relationship ended in January 2013. Thereafter, she cut her hair, made a bunch of new friends, Lena Dunham, Karlie Kloss, and Lorde, and moved from Nashville, where she had lived and worked since high school, to New York City. It's so refreshing to see people move on from the idea that all I do is sit in my lair and write songs about boys for revenge. I don't think anybody moved on from that.
The people who thought that, I think they still thought that during 1989. I like her optimistic delusion that
me too.
They're taking me seriously now. It's like, sure. That you think that. But the thing is, we always were. Everybody else mm-hmm. that she has to worry about, she's delusional about that.
Well, the duality of a woman and real feminism is you can sit in your lair and write songs about boys for revenge and also do other things too.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to me. It's like, okay, let's just say that she was sitting in her lair and writing songs about boys for revenge for bad things that they did to her. Lock her up and throw away the key. Like, I'm really looking for the crime there, and I can't find it.
It was interesting how she kept being like, 1989 is not about boys, 1989 is not about boys. When you go through the track list, girls, even when you put aside the like sexy, fun, poppy songs, Out of the Woods, All You Had to Do Was Stay, I Wish You Would, How You Get the Girl, This Love, Clean.
She was writing about kissing. She was writing about driving in the rain with a boy.
Crying.
She was writing about crying over a boy. She was writing about all these feelings associated with a boy. And you know what? She rallied and she said, this is my feminist record. And that means it kind of plays into what we were talking about with the Phoebe Bridgers record. For those who don't have the context, people are saying that Phoebe Bridgers is male-centered because she writes about her relationships on her new record. So it's like, Taylor's writing about boys on 1989 too. And the thing is, the male-centered thing is like, why can't you have life experiences and then write about them? And sometimes when you're, I don't know, a female who's attracted to men, sometimes that means you might write a song or two about a boy. Is that a crime? Are people being locked up for this? I didn't realize this was the gulag, and we weren't allowed to do that.
And as Taylor said, why don't you ask these questions to Ed Sheeran? Why? Who's writing love songs about it?
The fact that she used him repeatedly to mm-hmm. make her point, and he was cool enough. He was like, yeah, it's true.
He was like, speak on it, queen.
Speak on it, queen.
Then the article goes on to talk about her move to New York City, where the tourism organization announced them as her new global welcome ambassador, despite her being trapped inside more than she'd like. So this is how she describes her new relationship to her new city. If I'm in the mood to be held accountable for every single article of clothing on my body, whether it matches, if it clashes, if it's on trend, then I go out. If I'm not interested in undergoing that kind of debate and conversation regarding how I'm walking, whether I look tired, how my makeup is right, what's that mark on my knee, did I hurt myself, I just don't go out. At least the city's paparazzi are polite, she says. And yes, she knows how peculiar that rationalization sounds. Okay, again, the dissonance is so interesting to me, because like, moving to New York, the purpose of that was, my front door is my runway. You cannot look at the images of her walking out that door from this period of time that she is talking mm-hmm. about and not be like, this was all to get photographed. Those bags are empty, girls.
The bags are empty. The purses are empty. I would pay good money for a What's in My Bag video from Taylor Swift from 2014, because she's going to open it up and air will be inside of there. The tag. The unused bags that we have seen, I can't even get into it. And you know what? Thank God she did, because that runway, I mean, look over.
Oh, it was stunning. Every day a new outfit.
What I find really interesting is that she says the New York City paparazzi are polite. I think that's in comparison perhaps to, for example, maybe the Paris, France paparazzi, who it seems like once a week there's a new celebrity who has been tormented. When it was Hudson Williams, that was crazy.
Taylor is our classy first lady. She never let it slip in front of the paps, ever. I don't think she's ever expressed anger towards the paparazzi or like been frustrated. I think at one point she said, stop talking to me. She had her, she used to walk around with her headphones in. Yeah, you have to leave her alone. Yeah. Also in New York, weirdly, I think she is like they know where she is and they get her coming in and out and then they kind of leave it alone. I don't think she could walk down the street, but like she's relatively in a bubble, I suppose, in New York. This has only gotten worse though. So I don't know. She came on this shit mad as hell. She was really mad in this interview. Everything that she's saying is like,
it's like, okay, period. Period. And she should be.
She goes on. This was also before I think the media and the public in general had a collective reckoning about how capitalism is not feminism. So they tell this story. Swift likes to tell a story about how she came to be named Taylor. We all know this story. Her parents named her Taylor so that when she would submit her resume, people wouldn't know that she was a girl. They would consider her fairly. And the article says, the businesswoman wound up in Swift anyway. She has sponsorships with Diet Coke and Keds. And for the sake of album sales, she has aligned herself not only against Spotify, but with Target. More than a third of Swift's first week sales came at the retailer, where among the store-exclusive bonus tracks are 1989, are Swift's intimate voice memos explaining her craft. Like so many millennials born into the upper middle class, Swift has benefited from the demise of the concept of selling out. By now, Americans are used to brand's ubiquity, and her product placement is hardly intrusive. What does it matter, really, that style premiered in a Target commercial rather than in a small concert? Swift says her big sales figures matter because I realize how important of a statement it makes to everyone to whom statements are very important. That is a nonsensical sentence, by the way. An anxious industry needs some cheering up. What Joni Mitchell once called the star maker machinery, she's come up multiple times as well, has come to
on the mind
since the internet's rise. Many record stores have closed. Basically, what they're saying, the point that's being made here is by the writer and Taylor is, me selling all these albums is a net positive for the industry. I'm lifting everyone up and
trickle down capitalism.
True. And it's just funny because we see it now. I mean, I guess you could, I actually think you could make the argument that she re-sparked vinyl production and vinyl, like the interest in vinyl and collecting it and people are interested. So I would say she has revived that, but now it, instead of like leading the sales, it's now like, I wouldn't say taking sales from others, but I would say it's like blocking sales accomplishments from others.
This is interesting. This is like kind of reading a YouTube comment from a Charlie's Angel. She blocked Brat. Never
she
mind the fact
Brat.
That Brat wasn't even going to be number two.
No, never mind. That was the problem.
She blocked Brat. But it's interesting to me. It's funny because this was during the time period where, you know, Barbara Walters is saying Taylor Swift is the music industry.
And she was.
And
everybody
was
happy. And we were all so happy then. Little did we know just how terrible things would soon become. I think the part that's really interesting here is the line about brand's ubiquity and product placement. What does it really matter that style premiered in a Target commercial rather than in a small concert? I would argue slippery slope a little bit because now we're getting Cat's Eye. Cat's Eye is music that was like made to be product placement. Like that is created to be a brand tie-in, to like be a commercial for stuff. Whereas the good thing about Taylor doing that is that Target uses the music that would already be good and sellable in and of its own right, and they join forces for a joint sleigh. But now I think a lot of music is made with the Target commercial in mind.
You know what you and everybody watching, everybody listening, if you're interested in the subject, you know what movie you should watch? It's the greatest movie ever made. It makes you think. It makes you laugh. It makes you cry. It makes you clap. It serves cunt. It's a little film called Josie and the Pussycats. Greatest movie ever made.
And I haven't seen that. And people keep telling me that I would like it.
Good. And it's all about like, it's not as direct. I mean, obviously it's about brainwashing. So there's a little bit of that like directness in it, but like it's the excessive product placement in the movie when you're watching it is like they're hammering it home in such a specific way for people who are interested in that subject about like brands and like artists and like how it all kind of like comes into one and like being sold as a product. Josie and the Pussycats is a great film and it's cunty and it's Y2K as fuck. It makes you think.
No, it does make you think.
Tune in.
It really does make you think.
Watch it.
And then they kind of go on to talk about how Taylor's ambitions really are to sell as many albums as possible and to keep playing stadiums. Taylor then goes on to talk about the fans. So it's the first album of hers that leaked that didn't trend on Twitter. Do you remember the moral policing that we were doing about the leaks in 1989?
Yeah, I was there. Oh. I was putting people in jail. If I could have sent you to jail for copyright, oh, baby, I would have. That's how serious I took it.
I was sending the leaks to Taylor Nation directly because I had their email when they reached out to me for the potential 1989 secret session. And so I would email them every day being like, here's 10 people that are sharing leaks. Not me. I'm not sharing. I'm just saying it to you.
I'm not clicking. I'm not listening.
In case anyone's listening.
I was really on the anti-leak, especially for 1989, because, you know, here's a little bit of my lore. So when Red came out, I was in college, and I was in such a precarious... I didn't have a car, so I couldn't just, like, go pick up the album. You know what I mean? Like, go to Target. Mm-hmm. I would have gotten my dad to drive me, and I wasn't going to do that. I was an adult, so I wasn't going to be doing that. So I ordered it, and I was hoping that it would come, if not early, then at least on the day, and it didn't. So the album's out, and I can't access it. And even more so, I knew that because of the tracking. I knew it was going to be late. So I was like, what the fuck am I going to do? So I started listening to the leaks, and I listened to like half of the leaked album, and it gave me a really weird impression of it. The album. I was like, what the fuck? I chose the wrong songs. So like, I had this really, traumatic is a strong word, but I had this really
uncomfortable experience.
Yes, this dark experience with listening to Red for the first time. It was completely ruined. So I hated leaks before then because Taylor famously cried when mine leaked. And so it was a guilt trip for the ages. But like when I did that with Red, it really put in my mind, oh, leaks just ruin everything. So I was like anti-leak. Even if it wasn't for Taylor saying, I don't want it to leak, I would have done it anyway, because you people have repeatedly ruined everything.
No, yeah, it's true. And now we're the most anti-leak we've ever been. I used to pick two songs. I would pick two songs. I think I picked Style and randomly This Love or something like that. And I was like, oh no, I picked Bad Blood. Sorry, Bad Blood and something else. And I loved Bad Blood. It was the greatest song I'd ever heard. I was obsessed with it when I first heard it. And then I had like 2 weeks to wait. But after that, with Reputation, I had been to the secret session. So I was like, I don't need to engage with the leaks. And then Lover is the last album that I listened to a leak of. And I listened to the leak the day before. So... didn't really do anything bad, but I do remember listening to I Forgot That You Existed, no context, no lyrics in front of me, and was like, what the fuck?
See, you know what? It's ruined a lot of people's experiences. And, you know, I saw people downloading the Phoebe Bridgers Lost Weekend leak in 2026. I don't get it, babes. Them? Like, don't I tell actually me.
Don't tell me.
Get it. I do not understand, like, the 3 days before leak that everybody jumps on, like, wild animals. I'm like, you guys have no patience or self-control even to this point. Like, you really can't wait. Because it just immediately appears in your library now. It's like no effort whatsoever if you just waited a little bit. I truly don't understand it. Like, I'm now at the point where it's like the concept of a leak is totally foreign to me. Like, I honestly think I was trained.
No, we were her dogs. We were her Pavlovian dogs. She said, and this is how she trained us, because this is the quote she gave about the leaks. She says that she has enjoyed extreme, unconditional, wonderful loyalty that I never thought I'd receive in my life. Not from a best friend, not from a boyfriend, not from a husband, not from a dog.
She's saying we love you more than Abigail.
You're saying we love you more than Abigail?
She's saying, you know, Enchanted Swift 79.tumblr.com, who, by the way, just downloaded the entire 1989 album and is listening to it as we speak.
I love
free.
You more than Abigail.
I don't know if she was actually delusional or if this was her. I think this was her loyal to me.
Yeah, she was doing it in a way to reinforce the behavior. But like, that's the trick of the parasocial thing, is that she can never drop the act. She always has to do the act, which is why she just says nothing about the fans anymore, because she doesn't mean it. Ask her to say this again now.
You know, I think there's been so many strange experiences that she's had with fans up to this point. If she was secretly in her head like, God, I fucking hate them, I'd be like, I get it.
Yeah. I'm sure she does. It would shock me if she didn't.
It's just too much all the time. And like, even people who have the kindest intentions and only mean the best can behave strangely. You know what I mean? Like, give her like a weird feeling, like, this is bizarre. And she would never show it. Because well, she's
that's,
Mother Teresa.
And that's her power.
And Princess Diana.
She never shows it. I remember when she got kind of annoyed during the secret session, and I was like, the only reason why I'm able to pick up on this is because I'm not 16.
Right. No, there is like a level of, first of all, complete and total, like, I don't know, social blindness, mm-hmm. A? And like
devotion.
Also, yes, like you can't even see that she's doing an act because you're so... Oh, it's her. And she's doing the things that she does on camera too. It's like, yeah, you see how that, like, it's on camera.
It's on camera and there's a camera here.
Which isn't to say that, like, oh, she's lying. Oh, she's faking it. But it's a customer service voice. It's a customer service voice. Am I lying when somebody pulls up to the window and says, hi, can I get a, and I'm extremely nice to them and I give them a little drinky?
No, you're doing
no,
your job.
It's not a lie. No, I'm doing a J-O-B. Taylor has a J-O-B too.
She does. And I actually like where this ends. It ends in kind of an ominous place. Once her biggest fans signed the non-disclosure agreement, she would bake for them in her home and give them little bits of commentary about the tracks. Then they would pose for goofy Polaroids. On this final night, though, with the album finally in stores en route to sell nearly 1.3 million copies, the session has turned a little less secret than the others. She played her songs live, two for the first time, on a downtown rooftop, simulcasting the performance on Yahoo and iHeart stations to an audience worldwide. Behind her, the towers of the Financial District punctuated early evening amber skies, and the lights atop the Empire State Building, a versatile LED rig installed just 2 years ago, danced to the beat of Swift's just-released songs. I can picture this in my brain.
I'm seeing
4 years earlier, Swift first sang How the Kingdom Lights Shine Just for Me and You. On the ground, no one understood what was going on. But up on the roof, Swift's fans shimmied and shivered anything to ward off the evening's chill as they gazed up at their queen while she looked out over her new vast kingdom. It's so crazy.
It's crazy. Oh, he was really like...
That's C-U-L-T.
He picked up his pen and he said, I've witnessed something here and nobody here can realize it, but I see it for what it is. And the cult has formed. When people talk about Swifties being a cult today, I'm like, babe, you have no idea. Mm-mm. There was a time when we really all had the same thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
All of
there was
us.
A monoculture of Swiftie. And when you went afoul of that, the punishments...
Yeah.
The social humiliation rituals. Mm-hmm. Oh, nothing like what you see today. Because anybody's getting got for anything now. Back in the day, there were a few things that you could really get got and run off the internet for. And I love his tone. His tone is like the first person ever allowed into North Korea to see it for the first time and report back.
He's in awe. No, he's shaking. He's
like,
shaken.
The storefronts are full of fake products.
Soylent Green is people. He was like in awe of what he saw, as he should be.
It's awe-inspiring.
It is. I remember reading stuff like this back in the day, and I remember as a fan, I was like, that makes me so proud to be Swiftie.
Oh, yes,
this
no,
is us.
I would be like,
we
yes,
are Taylor Nation.
Our
we are Taylor. We are you. And it's like, man, it doesn't feel that way anymore because I know we've talked about this before, but like there's at least 150 different ways to be a Swiftie now. Didn't used to be that way. There was one way.
There was one
Taylor's
way.
Taylor's and it was way.
And it was a human right to be a Swiftie in this way. Now it's like, I don't know. There's no consensus around what being a Swiftie even is. Like, think about it. For years, Madeline and I would be able to recognize the other longtime Swifties. There was a group of us that didn't even really know each other that well, but like knew of each other, moved in similar circles.
Right.
They all had like followings of their own, I would say. And we were the OGs. And now look at this.
Yeah,
now
this
we have
is
Chris
kind
Olsen.
Of a, we have many, many Swifties out there. Swifties out there in the world. One of the greatest examples is when people get upset when you talk about her relationships in detail. It's like, oh man, like
you really
I
should have been on Tumblr in
yeah,
2010.
I,
oh my
I don't
god
know how to express to you how crazy it is for people to get upset about that to me, because it's like, oh girl, this
That's
is what it is to
is.
Me
That's
like
what, it,
what
is.
It is. Mm-hmm. And I have to understand why people who are newer fans, and especially younger ones, don't see it that way, because they weren't there. And it's like, I get it, but I do. And it's like, it's fine if you don't get it. But what I do need is for the comments to cease and desist.
respect your elders.
Yes. So
I think just some honestly, it boils down to, I think I know more about American Girl dolls than you do, genius.
Unfortunately, I do because I was there.
No,
I was there. Everything that happened, I was there. That's the thing. It's like,
and there's a distinction between being there and being aware of what was going on and being online in the fandom. Completely different experiences.
We could make like the most detailed video about any Tay Rewind, and we could do any interview, and it still wouldn't be the same. You could never get to the heart of what it was actually like to like be in the fandom when something like this would hit Tumblr, when a new album came out.
Oh my God. It was like every day you would wake up and it was a new gift delivered to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Candids. I remember when nothing kind of makes me feel like an old like Swiftie or like back when I was 16 than like a new, fresh, really nice Candid of Taylor. Because like when the Candids used to hit like at least once a week of Taylor, it was like, oh my God, new pictures. And it would be like, you know, new things for me to edit, new things for me to do on the internet and talk about with other people, like-minded individuals. And it's like now, I mean, I can't express to you how different it is when a new
now it's evil.
Hits.
Now it's she looks like she's a helmet, or like I hate her hair, and it's like, you know what? What happened? Whatever happened to shut up and eat your food? This is why I stopped doing hair, bag, and shoe, because people take it too fucking seriously.
Yeah, people take it way too seriously. It used to be a key. Like, yeah, we would talk about like, I don't like that outfit, or her hair looks different, or oh my God, she's wearing red lipstick, you know, stuff like that. Like, yes, we would talk about it, but it never felt the way that it feels now, because everything is so like,
anyone,
I don't know how else to describe it.
Tumblr also felt private. It was like a private community. Yeah. Like, you, not just anybody could get on there. So I think that also made it feel a bit more like homely. But what I will say is, and not to plug, but the closest simulation of what Tumblr used to be like, or what the fandom used to be like in general, because this extended to Twitter too, is our Patreon. Because I feel like we are modeling how it want, like, we're literally being the change that we wish to see in the world. And like, when I want to talk Taylor, or I want to read funny comments that understand the tone that I want to talk Taylor about, I go to my own fucking Patreon full of people that have been, if they weren't there, they've been trained. By us.
If they weren't there, they've been trained. It's true. It's true. No, there's a vibe. There's a vibe check. There's a vibe check.
There so is. Really, honestly, the message of this video is that you need to gaze up at your queen, Evolution of a Snake, while she looks out over her new vast kingdom, the Patreon.
Exactly.
Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.